All right, good morning, everybody. Wednesday morning, October 20th, 9:03. And good morning. How's everybody doing this morning? I was trying to figure out a plan for this morning, and I was looking at some of the videos that I had and where I was leaving off with the multi-step synthesis. And in terms of getting those videos together, the first one is put together, but I've got many more that I need to put together. I have all the film done. They're all in these short little snippets, and I got to do the filmmaker thing and go and stitch them all together and make the video, which in the past hasn't taken me an enormous amount of time, but it does. It is kind of a time sink when I start it. I'm kind of at a loss for where I want to go. I don't want to go too much further with the multi-step today. And you guys are working on an exam for Monday. So you've got the exam kind of up and going, which means that doing review problems right now, we could, but I think it's more, it may be more valuable to use it kind of like open office hours or things that you guys are struggling with at this point. I'm just thinking in terms of lab, I don't really want to go forward with the lab. And in terms of lecture, I don't want to overwhelm you with more lecture and taking the lecture forward in the lab component space. So so that means kind of an open lab day, an open day where we just shoot at me what you guys have. What are you guys struggling with? What do you guys need? What support do you need in order to get that test done? Or have you even looked at the test yet to see what's there? Any thoughts?
Yeah, some of us met up yesterday and started working on the test.
That's great. That's excellent.
Yeah. It was good. There were some parts where we had some questions where we didn't really know what would happen. I don't know if it's appropriate for us to talk about that here.
Sure. Let me see. Why don't you let me pull up the test real quick, so I can look at it at the same time. I mean, I'll give you whatever direction I think is appropriate. And if I think that's something that you guys just need to spend a little bit more time with and tackle, I'll let you know. So it never hurts to ask. Oh, come on, I was in the right spot already. Modules, exam. Okay, I got it. All right, what have you got?
For number two.
Which one?
Number two on the exam.
Yep.
Basically, we were looking at the carbon that the alcohol with the protecting group on,
yep,
is located at, and we were trying to figure out by putting the Grignard in there if it would react just with the carbonyl, or if there was a possibility that it would react with the alkene that's over there.
Oh, okay.
And we're trying to look at resonance from that oxygen and like if it would potentially be electron donating. But I don't know how it behaves with the protecting group on there or any of that stuff.
Okay. So can you guys see the cursor on the screen at all when I move the cursor? Okay. So this is the question that we're talking about. And you've got the OTMS group that's here. And you're worried about this double bond component and how that may interact with the Grignard. Aldehydes are extremely reactive. Okay. The partial positive in this molecule, actually, I'm going to do this in a different way because I want to actually be able to write on the exam. So let me do this. Give me one more second and I'll bring it into Notability. And then I can actually use a pointer and I can mark things up. And it'll be a little bit easier. Okay. 5 minutes, 5 day. Okay, and then the only other thing that that does is get me to stop the share and take the screen share over to the cable iPad. And Bob's your uncle, we're in. Okay. Here's the thing that's going on with that. When you look at a reaction like this in number two, your Grignard clearly has the negative charge and is the carbanion. So that's the carbanion. And that carbon that bears that negative charge is that carbon that's right there. That thing is your nucleophile. And that means that that's going to be looking for an electrophile. So that's going to be looking for either a full positive or a partial positive. And this molecule is that electrophile. So when we analyze this molecule in kind of what's going on with it, there are two locations to be thoughtful of. The first location is that location right there, where the base of the carbonyl, because of the electronegativity of the oxygen and the dipole moment at that position, it makes that carbon partial positive. And that's your electrophilic position. Now, when you have this type of structure, and we have not covered this yet, but it's a valid question. When you have this type of structure, you could consider resonance associated with a structure like this. It is a minor resonance contributor. But that minor resonance contributor means that when you look at the overall structure of what we call a conjugated ketone or aldehyde, so we could put a hydrogen here too, and it's valid. What it means is that you have a partial positive that is at the base and a partial positive that is at the terminal end. And so there are two electrophilic sites. Your two electrophilic sites are here and here. Now, we haven't discussed this in class before, so this was not the intention. But also, your question as to what is that TMS group doing is a valid question. And if we look at the lone pairs on that TMS group and the way that they push, they can push this way and that way, which means that I'm actually getting not quite a partial positive at that terminal end, but a partial minus at that terminal end. Because this OTMS group is an electron donating group. And so that makes that terminal end nucleophilic rather than electrophilic. So it's not going to react with this other nucleophile. Go ahead.
We were looking at that resonance. And so, yeah, if you push those electrons out, then you have the you know negative charge out there at the end of that alkene. But at that carbon, the other carbon that's at the tertiary position, because those are pushed out, does that make the carbon more positive?
Oh, no, it doesn't.
Okay.
So what you're looking at there is if we take a look at that molecule, and we look at what this oxygen can do, it can push in, it can push out. What that does is contribute to a partial minus on the terminal carbon, but does not really affect the carbon that the oxygen is sitting on. So the question is, what is going on at this position? And the answer that what is going on in that position is that that position is affected only by induction. And it has a partial positive by the oxygen just the inductive effects of the oxygen pulling. But even though that carbon has a partial positive, there's no leaving group such that if the nucleophile attacked, something else could be kicked out. An OTMS group is not a good leaving group. There is no stability for the oxygen anion as it leaves being attached to a silicon. So silicons are actually electron donating as opposed to electron withdrawing. They are more donating than a carbon is. And so the silicon really sort of attenuates the oxygen in its electron withdrawing abilities. And so this thing, if it were to try to leave, would have to bear a large negative on that oxygen. And it really just doesn't want to leave. It doesn't want to do that. So there's no leaving group that's attached on that position. So really, the intention was a straightforward intention that you would be reacting at that carbonyl center as opposed to the other center.
Okay, cool.
All right. So that, yeah, I don't want to be misleading there. And really, the design of the exam from a design standpoint is the first part of the exam when you go through and all the questions are mandatory. These questions are what I sort of call the low-hanging fruit, or not low-hanging fruit, maybe I should say base skill sets. These are the skill sets that I want everybody to nail, and they should be fairly straightforward. So there shouldn't be anything that is that is big problem solving in this first section. And then you get down to the optional section where you got to choose three out of the following questions. This section takes a little bit more time and takes a little more thoughtfulness in going through and asking mechanistic questions that we've discussed before, but are presented possibly in new ways or more interesting ways, and requires you to really put some thought into the types of things that you're asking right now on the first part. Those are the types of questions you really want to ask on the second part of the exam.
The only reason that I asked about number two was it seemed pretty straightforward. All of us thought it was pretty straightforward. It was the wording. It was what was said, don't speed through too fast and slow down and pay attention. And so we were like, well, what does that mean?
That means this. That means pay attention to the second step.
I see.
Second step is straightforward, but you just gotta pay attention to what happens after that second step in looking at the molecule and watching your functional groups. That's all.
Okay.
Hey Travis, you said all of us thought it was pretty straightforward. What did you mean by that? Is there a certain time all of you guys are meeting?
We set up like a study group a few weeks ago, something like that.
Did you do that through the Discord, or
I don't remember how we did it. I think I posted something somewhere and Brian had gotten it started, and we got phone numbers and just put a message out there for whoever else wanted to participate.
I definitely need to get in on that.
Yeah, totally.
I think you could add my phone number. Is there a group text or something?
Yeah, there is. And I'd be more than happy to add you. I'm so sorry. I didn't know that you weren't.
Karina, why don't you shoot him a private message in the chat and send him your number.
Sounds good.
Cool.
Awesome. I'm good. This is good. This is a good use of time then.
Yeah. Okay. Does anybody else have anything right now? Otherwise, I have another question.
Reto had a question that he was kind of breaking in there. Let me make sure we covered his question too.
Yeah, I forgot that. So,
all right, Travis, you're on a roll, buddy.
Okay. All right. So for number six on the exam, I think that's where we were working. We got all confused. Yeah, because five we ended up getting, okay, so six. The second to last step, so after the addition of magnesium, that creates the...
Oh.
That creates the Grignard. Okay, so then, you know, I don't know. I don't want to give stuff away, but
I hear you.
Once we're at that position, there's I don't know. I can just say like there's an oxygen hanging off somewhere that we don't really know what happens to it if it's just as an oxygen with a negative charge and three lone pairs on it, or if it's got a hydrogen on there. We were confused by that, and then going to the next, to the last step. I don't know how we could talk about this without, you know.
Okay, let me see what I can do. First off, I'm seeing that I think I may have an error in wording. I think that should be intra.
Right, that's kind of what we assumed.
Yeah, we definitely didn't catch it as inter.
Okay, yeah.
How can I make polymers?
Yeah, should be intra. So a catch there real quick. So what I normally do in these instances, when I'm met with reagents or reactions like this, we can look at the reagent and we can ask, you know, what is it that this reagent typically does? What does this reagent typically work on? Right. So a reagent like PBr3 usually converts an alcohol to a bromide. And so we would be looking for some alcohol to convert into a bromide in terms of that. We could go through each one of these steps, you know, creating the Grignard. You've got an epoxide here. We've seen reactions like this. This reagent was one that we just covered the other day. Mm-hmm. So this is the thionyl chloride DMSO and triethylamine. This is what we covered actually yesterday. This is the Swern oxidation. So we can even put a name to that.
That was pretty straightforward. We understood that.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. So then we get down to this one, bromine and light. So the bromine and light there, Br2 and light, would be the free radical bromination. And then you're making the Grignard again, and then the intramolecular reaction. And then this last reagent, what is this last reagent?
That chromic acid, is that Jones?
That's Jones, exactly. And so that's an oxidation. So you said that there was concern about some alcohol group that appears here in terms of its oxidation.
Well, we weren't sure if there is alcohol or not, whether the hydrogen is there or not, because we didn't know where it comes from.
Oh.
Because we don't see the hydrogen on the oxygen at that step to then go and use the Jones.
Okay, so let's be clear then. Let's do this. Let me add a page. So without talking about the structures or giving away structures that are there, what we can say is that when you look at a primary alcohol, Jones will oxidize, so CrO3H2SO4, Jones will oxidize this first to the aldehyde, but an aldehyde is more oxidizable than is the beginning alcohol, and that will continue to oxidize onto a carboxylic acid. And so what's the proton that I was discussing that was an important proton was the proton attached at that carbon, which is the carbon that is undergoing oxidation. It's that proton that's important, not a proton on the oxygen that way. So this is a primary. When we look at a secondary alcohol can be oxidized with Jones, and it will oxidize up to a ketone and will stop because you lose this proton. That's the carbon that's undergoing oxidation. And this is the proton that is being pulled by the base, pushing the electrons into the oxygen, making the double bond when the oxygen then lets go of electrons to the metal. And so that's where the oxidation occurs. The last one was a tertiary alcohol that with chromic acid does not have a reaction. And then the only other thing that I would add to this is that if we look at taking CrO3, H2SO4, and a ketone, there's no proton on the ketone, so there's no reaction here. So ketones can't be oxidized. Tertiary alcohols can't be oxidized. And primaries go through the aldehyde, and the aldehyde is oxidized to a carboxylic acid. Aldehydes themselves, we could take and we could say, if there's an aldehyde in the molecule, that with chromic acid Jones, that this will oxidize up to the carboxylic acid. But that's oxidation of a carbonyl separate from the alcohols themselves.
What about what about oxidation of just an oxygen? There's a carbon, the hydrogen is attached to the carbon, but we don't see that there, it's not an alcohol, it's just an oxygen with lone pairs.
Okay, but when you say an oxygen with lone pairs,
it's an alcohol with three lone pairs, so it has a negative charge on it.
Oh.
What?
Okay, I see what you're saying. You're worried about after doing this step that there was no acid that came after this step.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Now I'm understanding. All right, so we could change that in two ways. We could say one, we could do that. Two, we could put in dilute acid. Or we could recognize that as we move on, that this step is acid and that this would protonate whatever happened to be there.
We saw that. We saw the acid.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess that maybe it may have just been in the order of them that was confusing to us. Or not fully understanding the mechanism, like, oh, that's part of it.
Seems like I should have added this. Seems like this is a component that was missing, that I should have added dilute acid there, and that would have made it more clear. But that was good on you guys on taking it literally. There's no acid there. I should be getting an O minus here. So you guys are square on. That was an appropriate response to that question without the dilute acid.
So what actually will happen is Jones will protonate.
Yes.
And then do whatever it does.
That's right.
Hmm.
That's right. So just treat it as if there was dilute acid in here. Go ahead and give me not an ion here, but give me the alcohol. And then go ahead and carry it through in the way that it should be carried through. I wasn't completely understanding the question now. So terminology-wise, I was thinking that you were talking about an ether, but you're actually talking about this, which is an alkoxide.
Exactly.
So that's an alkoxide ion. Alkoxide anion. And yes, those will undergo oxidation as well because of the acidity of any of the reagents that we're using here for oxidation. So they would all be able to protonate that and carry that forward. We would treat that as an alcohol. The thing that I thought you were asking about was looking at ethers. And this type of molecule, when there's lone pairs and another, even if there's a proton that's here, if you try to do Jones, there's no reaction. That ethers are not oxidizable, despite there being a proton that is adjacent to them. Because you also have to have a leaving group. You also have to be able to get rid of the proton that is this proton has to be able to be gotten rid of in order to do the oxidation. And if that's an actual carbon group, then it can't be oxidized. Cool. Okay, good. What else can we fix? I don't feel bad about this because these are things that This is good. These are unintended issues that you guys are wrestling with. And I don't want to have those unintended issues. I want things to be straightforward in terms of the problems that you're dealing with.
Yeah, those all look interesting. I don't think we got that far.
You didn't quite get to 8 yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, these are puzzle type problems. And so these get to stereochemical questions. You have a compound A. When A is done with ozonolysis and a reductive workup, you get propanol as the only product. If you take A and react it with MCPBA and then do the oxidation component, or actually this is sodium hydroxide, water, and we're saying this is an SN2 reaction, we get a mesodiol. And so we need to understand what meso is. And you got to work back and figure out what that mesodiol is and what that means for what A was. And the hint really comes from over from here. So you got to build back from this to the possibilities of A, to what B actually is, back to selecting what the actual right compound for A is. So you kind of got to work in multiple directions. These are kind of fun problems. These start getting into puzzle type problems. This one was an arrow drawing problem. So the resonance structures are all given to you. It's just asking for you to include the arrows. And that means the right types of arrows. So watching your arrows. Another synthesis problem.
So actually with the previous one there.
Yeah.
We're always just going from like left to right. Really there's two sets for a second one. There's two sets of arrows, one if you move leftwards and one if you move rightwards, but we only draw the one that goes to the right.
Yeah, just move from left to right. Standard resonance, left to right.
Is there another kind of like scheme to go forward and backwards? Like
no.
One line goes forward, one line goes backwards, or are you just kind of like the reader is smart enough to figure that out by themselves?
Anybody who's looking at resonance contributors like that and looking at the flow of electrons could certainly push the electrons backwards in order to go back to the original structure. You're basically just reversing the arrows, whatever arrows you put in, you're reversing them in order to go from right to left. So yeah, we just work in the standard direction. We just work left to right.
And one question for 5. So here, I don't know, like you have to think about how the molecules are oriented. Would you state the problem so it's trivial then before you start solving it once you figured it out? Or will you just go ahead and like twist and turn them whenever is necessary?
Twist and turn whatever is necessary.
At whatever point it becomes necessary.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's just sort of that mapping idea that most of the problems that we have done, I have consistently kept the starting material and the product aligned so that the mapping was clear, right? And so most of the time when we've done a problem like this, the structure has been that we take and we include some other component into it, and you can map it fairly easily, right? But if we try to do that mapping with this one up here and we say, all right, here's my structure, this doesn't work, right? Because all of a sudden it looks like a carbon got converted into an oxygen, and we know that that's not happening. So clearly the mapping isn't aligned in the same way that many of the other problems that we've had here have been. So that means that you're going to need to look at this and find a new mapping within this structure someplace.
And then you draw it the way it is until you need to flip and twist it, whatever.
Yeah, one of the biggest, most important skill sets that I could push, that I typically do tend to push, is that when you start off on a direction, when you decide an orientation and a way in which you're going to start to draw things, don't turn them around ever. Because when you start to turn them around, you start to make mistakes. So keeping them aligned in the same orientation as much as possible, all the way through the sequence, is a really good skill set to master, because it will help you to make less mistakes. So picking an orientation and then following that orientation throughout is a really good thing to try to do. You know, and we've
talked at the very end, you say those two are equivalent, but they're like backwards or something.
Yeah, at the very end, and you've seen me do that. At the end, I'll draw those three arrows or three lines that I use that means equivalent, and then I'll reorient the structure and draw it in a different way in order to make it look pretty after I've gone through and done everything. I took that symbol, that symbol's from math. I'm trying to remember where I picked up that symbol. I think it was in advanced linear algebra when we started using that, and proof by induction. And I think that symbol came in somewhere in that process, and I've used it throughout my career. Just every time I didn't want to use an equal sign, I always used an equivalent sign as opposed to an equal sign. Okay, so just watch the mapping in this one, because the mapping in that one is critical. I keep deleting a lot of things. I don't know what notes are going to be useful and what notes are not going to be useful. I think it's going to be more in the video than actual reviewing of the notes that this thing is going to be helpful. You know, and while we're on that mapping idea, this synthesis. The hint that I'll give you on this synthesis is that the mapping that looks to be the most convenient mapping may not be. In other words, it looks as though I should be able to map this and put it right here. And it looks like I'm adding that other piece there. That may not be the easiest way to go with this problem. There may be other mapping that is more convenient. And so don't just run with the obvious. Play with that one. Figure out what it is that needs to happen. This is a good synthesis too. And I'm giving you steps here. I think the other hint that I could give you is that when I say this synthesis can be done in as little as four steps, that means that there is a four-step sequence that will give you the synthesis. But by all means, it doesn't mean that that's the only way to do it. There may be 5, 6, 7 steps that you can accomplish the same thing. And it's the accomplishment of getting to the final product with the right reactions that I'm looking for. So a 4-step answer versus a 7-step answer get the same credit as long as they're both correct. You don't get any more credit for doing it in 4 steps versus a brute force approach that would get it there in 7. So I just want to acknowledge that as well.
Every step has room for error, though. So if you have the least number of steps and it seems reasonable, you're probably right.
Well, I guess the way that I would put that is, yes, if you can do it in 4 steps, that's outstanding. And you would make more product because you're using less steps and there's less loss and percent loss and all of those things. However, just seeing how to get there and stitching the reactions together to make the product is really the skill that I'm looking for right now. And that's a major accomplishment in and of itself. And so I'm going to acknowledge whatever synthesis you give me, as long as the steps are correct, I'm going to give it full credit. So number one was straightforward. It was just nomenclature. Number two, we've discussed. Number three, synthons and looking at synthetic equivalents for those synthons. So there, the synthetic equivalents, these are the molecules that would have the properties of these guys. So that's what we're looking for there in number three. Number four, you've got radical resonance to show me. Number five, we were talking about that synthesis already, and the mapping is one of the critical components in number five. Number six, we've beat into the ground a little bit there. Number seven is pretty straightforward decision-making. So this is a reaction mechanism that we have done before with standard alkynes. But here, what I want you to do is I've put a functional group on the terminal end of that alkyne, and I want to see how that influences things. And so this is about critical decision-making and in looking at your options when there are multiple options of the ways that molecules can react, and then figuring out which of those is the lowest energy and which is the direction forward. So that's what number seven is about. Oh, and you need to explain your reasoning. So it's not generally just about choosing the lowest energy or what is the most stable. I also want you to tell me why it's the most stable. What's important about it that makes it different between the two choices? And that usually implies explaining both sides, because you can't explain one side to say why one is lower in energy unless you also explain why the other is higher in energy. So I want good explanations on number seven. Number eight, we talked a bit about, that's a puzzle problem. So here, no guessing. You need rationale for your answers, meaning that if you're picking specific stereoisomers, then I want to know why you're picking those stereoisomers. I want to know what it is about the problem that dictates the necessity of one stereoisomer over another. In this one, it's not just the arrow pushing. I'm also asking you to indicate the two most stable resonance contributors and then explain why your two chosen molecules are more stable than the remaining two. So we're looking at the factors of stability that are in here. So there's a little more than just arrow pushing to get the right answer. It's picking the two major resonance contributors and saying why they are the most stable, why they are those important resonance contributors. 10, straight up synthesis. 11, straight up synthesis. And 12, also synthesis. A little bit easier mapping perhaps in 12. And I think that's it.
So for some dead ends, we went down to WebMO to see whether the bond order is high enough to actually justify a transfer this way or that, and it never turned out to be right. So is that the only way we can kind of check that something is sane, apart from like thinking carefully through it and not missing anything?
I'm guessing that you're referring back to number two, where you might have looked at WebMO. Is that correct, or is that another problem?
I think that was one of them, yeah.
Okay.
Right. So it didn't work out. So the question is really, like, what do you do to make sure you're sane?
Well, I don't know that... Let me try something. And let's see, what do I need to do? Where did we go? Let me screen share this guy. Why is that not activating? I don't want to be in that window. I want to be up here. There we go. So if you were to go into WebMO and to do something like this, and the molecule has a structure that looks like this, and then I ask it to clean it up, do that, check it, make sure that it looks okay. So this is the structure that comes from problem two. And if I orient it this way, this is sort of our structure. We've got the aldehyde, we've got the double bond, we've got the oxygen, the sulfur group. So this is the TMS group, and the oxygen with the sulfur is called the OTMS group. If we want to take that forward and ask WebMO to calculate it for us, and we choose geometry optimization, exam problem two, I do this at PM3, there's no charge on this molecule, that all should be about right. And then I refresh that, and it's done. So here's the molecule. So what do I get out of that job that I just did? What value did I get out of this? One of the places to look would be at the partial positive and negative charges. When I hit that button, what it does is it changes the sizes and colors of the spheres to represent blue as positive and red as negative. So it can be a little bit misleading and confusing, because I look at this and I see red, and I know that this atom is oxygen, and I know that this one is red and it's oxygen, but notice that these carbons are also red, right? And so what WebMO is doing is it's graphically showing me this data, some of which are positive and some of which are negative. The negative ones are shown in red, the positive ones are shown in blue, and this is showing me my electrophilic sites and nucleophilic sites. So anywhere where the positive is really big, that's an electrophilic site. And any place where it's red, that's a nucleophilic site. And so you can see that out here on this terminal carbon, remember how I said that this carbon out here on the double bond would bear a partial negative because of the electron donating capacity, the resonance donating capacity of this oxygen. And so that's the effect that oxygen is having. The oxygen over here is polarizing this carbon and making this carbon positive. Now, you also have to know something about reactivity. You have to know that these protons are not nucleophilic sites, right? That nothing is going to be attacking these protons because there's no leaving groups, and that's not part of the mechanism that we look at. So same thing with silicon. Nothing's really going to be attacking the silicon, because there's no leaving groups on the, these are methyls, or right now I've got them as hydrogens. I should put methyls out there instead of the hydrogens, but there's no leaving groups on this silicon. So nothing's gonna be coming in and attacking the silicon because it doesn't have a leaving group attached to it in an appropriate way. So really what that tells me is that this carbon is really the only electrophilic site. There's another way that I could kind of view that data, and that is to ask it to calculate Huckel molecular orbitals. And along with those molecular orbitals, when it calculates them, let's see if it gives it to me. I could go back and calculate it, but maybe what I want is the electrostatic potential. I think I don't like to use it from this menu very often, but what this shows is the nucleophilic sites and the electrophilic sites and where they're located on an electron density map of the molecule. So where it's blue, the region in blue, which is hovering over that aldehyde carbon, that region of blue over that aldehyde carbon, and you can see it a little bit. I don't know how well you guys can see it, but I get a little bit of blue sheen on it right in here too. That aldehyde carbon is the electrophilic site where the blue is. It's where that blue color is. That's where the thing is really the most electrophilic reactive. And where it's red, that's where it's nucleophilic and has the potential to act as a nucleophile in some cases. Can this oxygen really act as a nucleophile? Well, in a sense, because it can be protonated by acids, and that is a nucleophile-electrophile interaction. And so this oxygen, in its ability to be protonated, that's what that red is really reflecting there. Why? And this has a little bit of yellow-red to it as well. This could be protonated as well, but you can see that that carbonyl is much more likely to be protonated than this oxygen is. And the reason is that this oxygen, its lone pairs are tied up in resonance and not available for protonation. So there are different ways to use WebMO to access or answer the questions that you're asking, Reto. It's a good question. The way to do that is to know how to use WebMO well to be able to visualize the information that you're trying to get. So just basically, nucleophilic sites, electrophilic sites, I would tend to just go with the partial charges and look at the partial charges and then also recognize what elements you're looking at, right? So that you know your carbons and you know your oxygens and you keep in mind your mechanism that we've learned, right? So the mechanisms that we learned were attacking at carbonyls. And if you had an idea that maybe you could attack out here at this one, as soon as we see that that one is red, that means that it's nucleophilic, not electrophilic. And so that would tell you that these two carbons here, I should not be considering. I should really only be focusing on this carbon. Does that
right. help? Yeah, and usually the problems are straightforward enough that you can do it by hand. You don't need to go look there.
There's you don't need to go all the way to WebMO, but I certainly do recognize that WebMO is a good tool and that used appropriately, it can answer or help to answer a lot of questions when things get tricky. You know, particularly looking at isomers and stability of those isomers. If you put those isomers into WebMO and you compare their energies, you have to be a little bit careful, but if they're structural isomers, then their energies should be directly comparable. As long as they're structural isomers, and as long as the structures that you've drawn are reasonable, then you should be able to compare energies there. But I don't think that you need to. You have enough skills to not have to go to WebMO for most of the things that are here. If I gave you a problem where I thought WebMO was going to be really helpful, I'd probably tell you so in the problem itself and say, hey, this is something that might be surprising. Go check it out in WebMO, see what it looks like.
Thanks.
Yeah. So anything else coming up? And if not, I have two proposals that we can consider here. One is that I can bow out and make somebody else in charge of this session to keep the session open, and you guys can chat among yourselves and work on problems and work on the test and utilize this time appropriately. Or we can ditch out and I can see you guys at 11:15. And you can work independently.
I like that first option.
You like the first option, Karina?
Yeah.
Sometimes me bowing out and letting you guys talk is more productive than me sitting here and everybody being hesitant to speak because I'm sitting in the room. All right, why don't I do that? Why don't I go ahead and bow out, let you guys work for a little bit, and you can coordinate, work on some problems, talk through some things, and I'll jump back on the line at 11:15 and we'll keep lecture rolling.
The other one, right? The other channel.
Yeah, on the other channel, exactly.
Cool.
Okay.
Can you turn off the recording?
Yeah, I can stop the recording.
Okay.
Yeah, let me do that. All right.